everyone, and welcome to another episode of Grounded. I am your host, Piper, joined by co-host Gunnar. We're excited to kick things off today. We've got a special guest, Chris, with the Soil Inventory Project. Chris, thanks for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Chris Cuffey. I am the co-founder and president of the Soil Inventory Project, and I'm also an assistant professor of environmental studies and sciences at Skidmore.
Awesome. We also have Lars with us today. Again, I think this is probably what, the third episode that you've been on here with us. I don't think we need to waste time with another introduction, but Lars, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having Chris and I. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Of course. I think it'd be great.
Folks can't see this, but Lars and Chris are matching. And I know that visual won't come through, but they both got checkered shirts on. So Gunnar and I missed the memo today.
Yeah. All right. I know. I've got the same shirt in my closet, probably two or three of them. I should have had a little bit of an advanced warning there. But anyways, Chris, could you tell us what the Soil Inventory Project is? I've been doing some reading, and it's some pretty exciting stuff that you guys are doing.
Yeah, the Soil Inventory Project is a science-led nonprofit, and we're doing a couple of things. We're building a national-scale soil carbon inventory. And in order to do that, we've been making and leasing new tools to make in-field sampling easier and more accessible to landowners. And so that goes everything from hardware, really low cost hardware that, you can run with a drill off from Home Depot, to web and mobile applications to do things like sampling design, track samples, and then to provide reporting. And then we're building an inventory because we want to bring together data. So another leg in the stool is thinking about innovative data partnerships, who has data and is in a position to share that data. And then how do we use that to feed sort of cutting edge modeling that can make everyone's inventory more valuable, right? The lower cost the inventory is and the richer information you can get, the better it's connected to management information, outcomes, and predictive of real outcomes, the more valuable it is. And then the more you have broad inventory so that you can compare your local inventory to like farms around you and trusted inventory, the more valuable that information becomes to growers.
Can you elaborate inventory? Like, can you expand on inventory? Like, what are we talking about when we talk about inventory?
So I think, I guess from my perspective, I think it's important to say that I'm not a soil scientist. I've never been a soil scientist. I'm a forester by training. And when you think about why we have really successful forest management, where we have really successful forest management, and why we have really robust markets around forestry, and I mean that both from an agronomic perspective, robust markets that really do a good job of valuing forest land and predicting forest output, and ecosystem service markets related to forests. They really have led the charge in carbon markets. And why is that? And the reason is that inventory, counting of wood, is something that, we started with the Germans in the 1700s. The first ideas of sustainability come from sustained yield. And sustained yield is based on the idea that we can count wood in a forest, and we can predict how it's going to grow so that we know how much wood we're going to grow over the next 100 years, and then how we can harvest that in a sustainable way, right? The idea that the counting of wood as an economic and strategic asset underlies everything we think about as forest markets today. And when I, ended up in a position where I was being asked to help private land managers better manage private lands, a big part of what I went looking for was soil inventory. The idea is, do we have the ability to produce robust measurements of soil properties at scale and map those? And I was incredibly surprised to see that there weren't huge databases. When you think about what the USDA Forest Inventory and Analysis produces for the United States every year, the thousands and thousands of plots all over the country that are then feeding information back into both public and private managers, there is no equivalent for soil. And this idea of taking a methodical approach to measuring, counting soil properties spatially I really saw that as missing. And so that's what we're trying to achieve. And so that's partially about how do you measure an acre? And it's partially about how do you bring all the measurements of acres that are happening together into one place.
Now, why do you think there is that gap that we don't have that database already? Is it, you know, I was a field technician for just under a year. So I know innately how difficult it can be to sample, you know, a single acre or a single field or a single ranch. But I also imagine that, you know, I think there's been a lot of emphasis on things other than soil for far too long. And so do you think it's the difficulty of the sampling itself in collecting this data, or do you think there's just been misalignment as far as where our priorities are, or probably a mix?
Yeah, it's one of those great yes. I get to the answer just yes to that question. I think that, you know, of course, the focus of measurement in agricultural systems has been for agronomics. And so we've largely, what you see is the soil in a bucket approach. I want one number for a field. It's a sort of simplified metric. What is the pH of this field? What is, you know, do I need to add nitrogen to this field? And that has really masked a whole lot of spatial variability or ignored a whole lot of spatial variability. And I want to be clear, this is completely facetious. But I would joke all the time that the two requirements to be a soil scientist were willingness to stand in a field and willingness to complain about variability. And because the needed outcome was at the field scale, right? That's facetious because the property that you needed to know, the field was the management unit, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas you look at trees, we talk about the stand as the management unit, but we recognize that the individual tree is the actor within the management unit. And so you necessarily need higher resolution information. I think as we started to try and crack the, you know, a lot of what we're inventorying, the soil carbon, when we started to look at that problem, we recognized that the field scale was an adequate representation of carbon. And I think increasingly, as you look at, you know, the things that are needed by precision agriculture, it's not adequate for a whole range of variables. And so what we really need is a revolution in the way that we are collecting soil information.
Certainly. Now, thinking of, you know, scalable and robust data sets, Lars, how does Earth Optics fit into the picture here?
I mean, a lot of the stuff that Earth Optics is trying to do is very similar to the things that TSIP and Chris are trying to accomplish. So we're just taking different approaches. We're engaging the commercial side of it, and Chris is going after the, you know, not-for-profit side, which allows him to do a bunch of things that we can't or wouldn't do. And same thing vice versa, right? Because we're profit motivated, we can enter a whole bunch of avenues that wouldn't be relevant for TSIP. But in general, Chris and I met, I think we were speaking on a panel together some years ago in Phoenix, and just kind of hit it off just even on the panel and went out for tacos and margaritas afterwards and then really hit it off. But I think we pretty quickly discovered that we were motivated by pretty much the same things and trying to answer the same set of questions. And they're like simple questions too, like right now, how much carbon is stored in America's working land soils and non-working land soils? Like right now, how many tons is it? You know, is it a million tons? Is it 10 million tons? And as far as when I started poking around, we don't know the answer to that to like within 100% factor. Like our best guess could probably be twice, that reality could be twice as high or half as much. Probably our best guess. Don't you agree, Chris?
Absolutely. And I actually think that's why the work we're doing is important. I think one could look at that and say, oh, that means this whole thing is not worth it. Or the fact that there's a problem means that there's a great opportunity to work on solutions. And I point to, you can look back, I think it was 2010 or 11. The lead author was a guy named Yude Pan, and it's an assessment of global forest carbon sequestration. Right in the abstract, you can see the number that they get to is 1.1 petagrams plus or minus 0.8 petagrams. That was the state of our knowledge. That's a Nature paper from 2010 or 11, I forget. That was the state of the knowledge. He and colleagues just put out an updated version of essentially the same paper, which marks it at 2.4. And I think the error term on that is 0.4. Right. And that is a much better, much more well-resolved system from a decade of labor. And I think that if we look, if, you know, we keep doing the work we're doing, Lars, you keep doing the work you're doing, we're going to see exactly the same thing happen for soil carbon, cultural systems. A whole lot of other soil variables are going to come with it. They're going to be linked to things like yield in the same way that those measurements are linked to forest productivity. And we're going to see that it's it really opens up a lot of opportunities for the space coming.
And Chris, not to like throw shade on your forestry background and the forestry systems, but like as someone who's removed from both of those things, including soil, I'm not a soil scientist either, nor a forester or a forest science. But like, you know, with the importance of atmospheric carbon concentrations, and you look at like, all right, where's carbon stored in our natural systems? Well, it's stored in the above ground biomass, but in the soil, and so with 5x the carbon estimated in the top 1 meter of soil, it's, to me, it was always surprising, like, why did we start with the 1/5 part? You know what I mean? Shouldn't we start with the 4/5 part? And the truth is you can't see it, right? You can't see when it's cut down or removed as easily. And so I think we spent a lot of time and money on one of the smaller storage pools of terrestrial carbon. And it's also a lot harder, you know, because you can't see it, you have to take a sample. You know, remote sensing is essentially useless in trying to characterize the spatial variability or just the absolute content at any location. So it's a lot harder, which is probably a big reason why we've kind of ignored it, but a lot more important.
Yeah, I open, you know, we have to write a lot of grant proposals because we don't, I think one of the great advantages you have, Lars, is you can tell people, hey, if you give me $1 million, there's a possibility I could give you $1,000,001 or $10 million back, right? Whereas I have to ask people for $1 million and tell them I'm going to give them $0 in return and all I'm going to do is make the world bigger, you know? So we have to have these really compelling opening paragraphs to our grants. And we're always talking about the relative size of these pools and the fact that there is, you know, more carbon in soil than in the atmosphere and the forests combined. And I think you're absolutely right. The part where you can see it is real. And I also think, you know, I think about the drawings that my daughter does. I've got a 9-year-old daughter, and I think about her drawing trees and the way that I learned as a child, right? You learn from very early age that trees pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and they make oxygen and they put the carbon into their wood. And that is a thing that you learn very, very early. Everyone knows. And then you layer upon the fact that foresters have been measuring wood because we needed to measure it as wood. And when it came time to make markets, they basically were able to raise their hand and say, just divide by two and you get carbon. And it's essentially that easy. It's more complicated than that, of course, but that's the system. And the same was not true for soils. So you can't see it. And it is a pain in the butt to measure. And it is very hard to remotely sense, which means you need to go out into the field. And I know, Lars, you know all too well how difficult that is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, what makes sorry, Piper.
Oh, no, I'm just going to attest to like the, you know, you don't realize the truth of that statement that like, oh, yeah, you can physically see a tree. And as like a non-soil scientist and a non-forester and a non-scientist across the board, I interact with soil every day in my garden, but like had never once considered it as like the potential carbon sink. And, you know, yet when you cut down a forest, everybody, I mean, naturally, because you've been raised with this concept of like, that's the one thing that kind of controls the terrestrial carbon. So
now, Chris, in your opinion, what are some of the differentiators between, you know, a ton of carbon that's stored in a forest setting versus a ton of carbon that is stored within the soil? Because it's still a ton of carbon, but it's not apples to apples, is it?
Well, and that's an interesting question. I think, you know, often I would differentiate between the pool and the flux, right? So it's one thing to say there's a ton of carbon there. Is that carbon, are you still pulling carbon from the atmosphere and putting it into the soil? And we think about that the same way in the forest. I think the longevity of that carbon, again, along with not being able to measure and model carbon as efficiently, that leaves you with questions about the longevity of agricultural carbon. Maybe we don't have the same questions for forests because we have really robust models, right? So when you think about that ton of carbon and you think about what you're going to do with it, the uncertainty on the future of it becomes really important, right? And I think we have a much better understanding of the uncertainty of wood and then what happens to it once it's been harvested and the modeling of sort of like post-forest product life cycle. Whereas with carbon, in soil, if you're going to lose, then it, you're not sort of modeling it through a product life cycle. You're just worried about the reversal. So I think there is some difference there.
Love Chris, it.
Go ahead, Gunnar.
No, I don't got nothing.
Oh, I was going to say, I felt like you were teeing us up for a conversation about how difficult it is to go out in the field and measure soil carbon. And as someone who runs and helps train all of our external sampling crews, I can personally attest to how difficult that is, not only to go out and just teach these various protocols, but just to get the right equipment in the right people's hands at the right time and place. You know, so is there something about this about TSIP that's making that easier? Is there, you have ideas about how we can make that more accessible?
Yeah. And I'd love, you know, I think we should, you all are tackling the same kinds of problems. And I think from two different perspectives, right? A lot of what we're doing is trying to lower the cost associated with friction and logistics from getting, I joke all the time, my job is to get geolocated dirt in a bag from as many places as possible and get them through a laboratory process, right? And so pretty early, you know, our first executive director that we hired is a fantastic woman named Sally Lambeau, who still serves as an advisor to us. And one of the first exercises she went through with me was looking at, she said, okay, what business are you in? You're in the geolocated dirt in a bag business. Where are your costs? Lay out your costs for me in getting geolocated dirt in a bag. And we very quickly saw that 70 cents of every inventory dollar in getting geolocated dirt in a bag and getting it to the other side of the laboratory process and turning it into a geolocated carbon value. 70 cents of every inventory dollar was a hotel room, an airplane, rental car, conversation with someone about how to deal with a gate, which road accessed what, and how do I get to this place? I can't see where I cross the stream, whatever the thing was. And that was really where all of our expenses were. And that really what we were then doing was getting a person to a place that a producer was last week and having them take a drill bit and stick it into the ground and throw the product into a bag and scan a QR code, right? And so could we do that as a distributed process? Which parts of that could be distributed? And so that's where we got to our auger-based system. It's a simple metal box. It runs on a drill from Home Depot. All the parts are cheap. And so we can send it in the mail. That's where we got to thinking about, okay, it's just a mobile application and sampling design is expensive, right? And I say that because, you know, I can write a paper that says, hey, just use CLHS. It's not the best always. Sometimes it's the best, but it's never the worst. So just use the CLHS and then use Polaris as a sort of like layer to throw down in the, and you can tell people that, good luck trying to implement that. So can we automate that so it's implemented and it's on the app? And so let's get rid of the friction of trying to choose points. We'll choose them for you. Let's get rid of the friction of labeling the bag. Let's get rid of the friction of choosing the labs, choosing the analysis, all of that stuff. And so we've been focused on that kind of inventory. And I think where that works particularly well is in remote or difficult to reach landscapes that are incredibly hard to move across. And it works very well for small holders where the cost of moving large pieces around the world is difficult. And I think it works for larger producers if they're interested. I think that for a lot of folks, if you're running a 5,000 acre farm, you're not wanting to get off your tractor a lot and may not work for you. And so I'd love to hear Lars's perspective on, you know, why you all have chosen the models and the methods that you've chosen. You see them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we actually took a very similar view and have a very similar cost structure in terms of what most of the cost goes into getting the human being to a particular latitude and longitude, less associated with what they do once they're actually there. And so we've tried to shave down those costs by integrating carbon measurement as much as is possible with agronomic measurement. Because that's, at least on row crop farms, that's something that happens, you know, on most farms and fields, you know, at least once every few years. And so it's for a long time been our view. It's like, well, why don't we just do both at the same time? And so we're, you know, we're not doing that. As a business, we serve agronomic customers equally as well as sustainability customers. And we're trying to drive those two customer sets together around a single measurement campaign. And we're you know, we're small successful today, but at least we've aligned our business to continue to get better at that. So it really same concept as you. So it's, instead of distributing it, we're just trying to go integrate with an activity that is already happening on that acre. One area that's definitely outside of that model is grasslands. Grasslands do not, right? They're not, no one measures fertility on grasslands. And there's, you know, around 800,000 acres of grasslands in the United States, around 200 million acres of row crop. And so from a row crop's incredibly important because, like, in addition to storing more carbon, row crop can be pretty good at losing carbon. And as we talked about with 5x the carbon in the soil than you have in the atmosphere, if you're losing it, that's, you know, that's a pretty big emission, right? So to me on row crop, it's just as important to make sure that you're not losing as much as you're trying to optimize actually additional sequestration. So row crop to me is something that's got to be continuously monitored. And it's kind of surprising that we haven't been, even now we're not doing it. Like it just, it surprises me that that's not just a thing that's constantly monitored. But on grasslands, yeah, you're still back to that very similar problem, but that's almost even an area where your approach may someday integrate with our approach quite nicely because you still have, you do have people on those ranches. They're just not trained soil technicians. And so there's, we've often thought about this probably, a, you know, there's probably a solution on grasslands that looks very similar to the way you guys approach it. That might actually be really cost effective to get someone who's locally working on the ranch and, you know, get them with the right kind of tools to allow them to collect some of this data on their own.
Yeah. And, you know, I agree on that, on the rangeland thing and on the importance of rangeland for climate carbon. I also, you know, we hear exactly the same thing about the agronomics. And I think we're in a similar position to you where it's not that the combining the agronomics and the carbon, not a huge part of what we do now, but certainly systems that we're building see huge demand for. And so what we have started to do is start to think about what we're calling goal-based sampling, where we see lots of people taking measurements for lots of different reasons. And they're kind of like carbon and carbon. It's kind of at the end of the sentence. They're like, I need to get my certification from the regenerative organic certification standard. And I'm interested in carbon. I need to sell to this up this supply chain and carbon. And so can we build sampling schema that achieve a whole range of goals? Because it really, again, the cost isn't getting to the place where you want to take the sample. Once you're there, we should be building systems that can serve a whole range of samples. So we, I see that exactly the same way.
So you mentioned a auger-based kind of harvesting soil harvesting tool. Can you tell us more about that? Like, how did you come up, or, you know, how did TSIP come up with the design? Why that design? You know, give us the details.
Yeah. So the auger-based sampling, you know, when we started, we were going out using push probes like everybody else, and mm-hmm. we were really focused. My colleague Charlie and I, along with some others, had started an organization called Quick Carbon, where we were trying to use an open source pocket spectrometer produced by a group called RSI. And we were trying to use that to make predictions in field of carbon. And we, in order to kind of try and feed that beast all the samples that it needed, we were going out and taking a lot of samples. And the push probe, I had never used one before. And I went out and I just said, well, this thing's lousy. And I'm a woodworker in my free time and I like to build things. And so I had a ship auger and I had drilled into trees with it before because I was sampling. I used to do a lot of work with methane emissions from trees and we would sample tree gas, you know, and of course you put an auger bit into a tree and all the wood shavings come out. And so I said, well, can I just drill into dirt too? And then we found some plastic bucket on the internet. And so our first model was a Home Depot bucket with a hole and duct tape in the bottom. And then we built out from there through all these other, and we said, oh, it's a lot easier. And then we started adding steps to the drill bit stops to get fixed depth and finding out that it was doing a very good job. And we've done published research showing that we get the same answer essentially as a push probe, but vastly faster. So playing a lot with that. And then we were really excited. We went out to California to work at Tomcat Ranch. Cat Taylor has been a great friend of TSIP and it has a beautiful ranch at Pescadero. We went out there to try and drill into the soil and found it to be very much like drilling into a rock. Our auger bit was completely useless. And I went back sort of heartbroken. And then again, I was on a building project and building a cabin, and we had to put rebar into bedrock. So I had to get a rotary hammer and use this masonry bit to drill into bedrock. And I was drilling into it, and all this dust was coming up out of the hole. And I said, wow, this is a lot like California. So we built what we call the California edition, which is a rotary hammer mounted version. And that works fantastically well in compacted clays. And now we're in a place where the soil and that's the other thing. We're a nonprofit, so we're always saying, steal our ideas, please. The idea is that these get scaled and used more so that more inventory is done. But the rotary hammer does a fantastic job of extracting from impossible soils. So we moved on to that. And so again, trying to hand a push probe to a farmer and saying, go do this, it's miserable. And the auger bit works really well. And so people say, oh, this is pleasant, I don't mind doing it. It's very quick. We get a stratified 0 to 15, 15 to 30 sample in about a minute and a half into two separate bags, QR coded, and we're on our way. And we can't get everything from that, but we can get a lot of what we need from that.
Definitely. It sounds like you guys have gone through a lot of the same trials and tribulations that we have. And I know Piper and Lars and I, we could spend, you know, probably countless years discussing, you know, what has gone well and what has gone wrong on various projects. And I've got a few, you know, infamous projects top of mind myself where, you know, it's incredibly difficult sometimes to go out and pull these samples. You know, we've discussed how difficult it can be to just get to that singular point itself. But then once you're there, you know, it can be, it's an intensive job. It's labor intensive. And so, you know, a lot of respect to everybody out there who is pulling these very valuable samples. Outside of the sampling itself, you know, we have a really exciting press release that will be released before this episode is aired. So we can talk freely about the press release. And one component of it that I was reading about and really excited about was the multi-model approach. And so, it sounds like there's a pretty intensive modeling component to this project at large. Chris, could you talk about what this multi-model approach is and why it's important and why it's really innovative?
Yeah, I'd love to. It's funny. It's funny. We spent, you know, we've been talking for, you know, 20 minutes or whatever. All we've talked about is getting geolocated dirt in the bag, which is the thing I do or think about most of the time. But TSIP, what we think makes us different beyond being nonprofit and science-led public interest entity, one of the things that made us different, particularly when we started, was the idea that, well, the recognition that the measurements are one part of the thing that we need, and that the modeling is the other part. You take the measurements, you need the model to scale it and to understand over large areas what's happening, and to compare areas and to understand which parts of those are biophysical and which parts are related to management. And also to make predictions forward in time, right? Because it's one thing to tell a grower, take this practice, you know, adopt this new practice, and you're going to get more of something, more carbon, or, you know, more drought resilience or bigger yields, right? But how much more is actually super important, right? The people, like what I just told you was a story about getting more yields. Stories don't run businesses. Numbers, spreadsheets run businesses. And so you need to be able to say how much more. And that comes out of the model, right? And then you again need to be able to take the outputs of the model and compare them back to additional measurements. How well is this model performing? So it's really in the marriage of the measurements and the modeling that you get the knowledge that can actually drive management, thus drive adoptions, and thus drive impact on climate or yield or supply chain or whatever it is you're interested in. So you need both of those. So the way that we've been modeling till now is that someone builds a model. And a lot of what we talk about when we talk about models, to be explicit, we're talking about process-based models as opposed to statistical models. So we're not just taking a whole bunch of data and drawing a line through it. That's a statistical model, right? Well, what do these data say is the prediction, right? This instead, these process-based models work back from first principles for our understanding of photosynthesis, its relationship to climate and soil and the variety of corn that you're planting and the fact that you're growing soybeans, right? And so understanding those basic properties of the system and then trying to make predictions based on it. That's what those models do. There are a whole bunch of them, right? right? So my colleague Bruno, who's the co-founder and of the Soil Inventory Project, Bruno Basso, from a professor at Michigan State. The model that he developed initially and led was the SALIS model. It's one of these process-based problems. There are a bunch of them. DASEP, for example, that you hear a lot of. The issue is that each of these model developers have a different background. They're working in a different system, both the biophysical system, the agricultural sort of overlay, the production system that's put on top of that biophysical system. They have a different viewpoint about what is the most important thing and how you weigh it. None of those are wrong. None of them are right. Some of them are more right sometimes than others, and some of them are more wrong than others sometimes, right? And so when you run one model, what you get is one view of reality, a reductive view, right? The point of a model is it's a simplification of reality. Well, when we do this for things that are really important to us, like global climate change, for example, when we look at the IPCC, they don't run one global climate model. They run them all, right? And in the case of global climate, something like 100 models, right? And you get one result out of this giant pile of models. And that's the median result. And it's kind of like getting a wisdom of crowds prediction, the famous story of trying to predict the weight of a bull when you can have a bunch of butchers do it, or you can have 250 random people do it, and the average guess of the 250 random people is better. So true for models. When you run a whole bunch of models at once, something really exciting, a bunch of really exciting things happen. One is you get a better prediction, which is great. We like having a better prediction. One of the other things that you get to see, though, is that sometimes models are giving you really bad predictions. It's not the same model giving you a bad prediction all the time. These are all good models. Sometimes a model gives you a great prediction in some circumstances. Sometimes it gives you a really bad prediction. The challenge is right now, when we're running one at a time, we don't know which one we're getting. So for the first time, Bruno we have a paper in review right now. We're about to release a multi-model ensemble for agriculture. 10 process-based models running all at the same time, giving you a median prediction. You can see all the models at once. And so you can see what is the range of variability from the models. So I can use that as an additional sort of way to understand uncertainty. Do I have a widespread in the models? And you can start to see, do I have a group of models clumping around the mean? Then with that sort of clustering, with that model convergence, as we say, we can start to have an idea that we have good faith that this is where the system is going. And so we really get a much more reliable result than when we run a single model. We've never done this with agriculture. This is going to be the first time, and we're going to make that freely available.
That's awesome. Really cool. Since it's, an agriculture focused model, is it constrained, primarily to like the Corn Belt? Are there any kind of like geographical constraints or anything else?
The models, the approach is broadly adaptable everywhere agricultural models work. Right now, we're releasing it for corn, wheat, and soy in the Midwestern United States. And of course, the obvious reasons for that. One, there's lots of data on corn, wheat, and soy in the Midwest, density. And that's one of the reasons why TSIP is bringing as much data to bear on the problem as we can, so we can expand to other places. So the data works well there. All the models perform really well there. And we think there's a ton of agricultural value there, both around climate outcomes and the products of agriculture. So we think it's a really important place to demonstrate the value of the model, both for its use on an individual farm and for your ability to set up dynamic regional baselines that allow you to avoid sort of contrived counterfactual baselines, which is most of how we do agriculture, right? I adopted no-till. And so the baseline is I didn't adopt no-till, and that would have happened if I had, right? And that is that counterfactual creates a real problem for markets.
Could we spend a little bit more time, too, just talking about how TSIP is going to benefit the agricultural community?
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. What we want to do is produce a whole bunch of things that are free, not because we wouldn't love to be a for-profit business. Wouldn't it be great? It would be a lot easier to raise money, and we'd be able to do things a lot more quickly. But by being a nonprofit, arm's length from these credits being generated. I don't care how many credits are made, and I don't care who gets them, sells them, and what they get paid for them, right? I want, when a credit gets made, I want it to be robust, and I want people to have faith that it, not faith, I want them to have confidence that it's grounded in the best available science. And so TSIP produces these predictions about carbon, what will happen if you, you know, adopt no-till, what will happen if you adopt a cover crop on your specific farm, and we can produce these sort of regional baselines that say this is what's happening on like farms around you who have similar biophysical constraints and have similar economic constraints, that this is the average and this is how you compare. In the same way that when you get your electrical bill and it says here was your consumption last month, this is how you compare to all your neighbors, and this is how you compare to your highly efficient neighbors, we want to be able to put carbon on the same kind of balance sheet for a farmer and say, this is how your farm has been performing relative to your peers. And by the way, your peers who've adopted no-till and cover cropping for this long, this is how they look. Oh, and also this is what we think this is going to do for your yields in the long run. Folks who have these properties get this much more yield. Oh, under a drought condition, wow, look at the delta between how they're performing in drought years and how the underperforming farms are performing during drought years, right? And that's actionable management information that then allows farmers to make the very real investment in adopting regenerative practices. And I mean very real investment, both in terms of what it costs you to buy new equipment, but also in the risk that you're taking in trying something new. You have to know where that's going. So we want to provide them not a regenerative agriculture flag wave. I happen to believe it's a good idea, but I'm not saying everyone should adopt it. I would like to give producers information they can trust to adopt it. And at the same time, you want to be able to give that information, trusted information, up to markets. And so I think this multi-model approach is a really powerful way.
As a Floridian, when you were saying multi-model approach, and I don't know if this relates, but all I am picturing is the hurricane models and the, you know, bajillion spaghetti. And I can attest that some are really good and some are really bad. And it's not always the same ones that are good. And it's not always the same ones that are bad. There are some favorites. And, you know, we put a high focus on that mean kind of line that runs through the group of them. That's what I kept picturing in my head as you were talking about that.
It is exactly like approach. And I think, you know, that range is a really interesting part of what you see for the first time in agriculture when you see the multi-model on paper, when you see it in growth. And that is that you look and you say, all of these are good models, right? There's nothing wrong with Dasein. Dasein's a great model. Picture all the work that went into that and how well validated that is. Salus, same thing. All these, same thing. They're giving you very different answers. And so different that you say, okay, I'm thinking about adopting cover crop and no-till. One of those models is almost always going to say, don't bother. And one of those models is almost always going to say, wow, this is a great idea. It's going to be a fantastic activity on your farm. You're going to get so much carbon. You're going to produce so much less N2O, and you're also going to have great yields and drought resilience. Awesome story. So one of them is going to tell you, definitely invest in this. And another one is going to tell you, definitely don't invest in this. You go to another farm, run the same suite of models, and they change positions. The practice hasn't changed. They've changed positions. And the output of the multi-model, I can say, because we've tuned this against a set of known places where practices have been adopted for a long period of time, the multi-model does a better job of predicting reality, which then means that you can sort of see that these other models sometimes are, you know, they say when the tide goes out, you can see who's not wearing their bathing suit. And when you see all of these models on one set of axes, what you see is that sometimes these models are out swimming naked.
The visual.
Whoops. Chris, I was going to make a joke or a half joke about the contrived counterfactual schema. I was joking that my kid tried getting paid for mowing the lawn using a counterfactual. He's like, well, had I not mowed the lawn, it would continue to grow afterwards after mowing. So you actually should just pay me twice for the... For mowing the lawn. I didn't bite on that. I'm still not a big fan of it in carbon credits either.
Yep. I think that is exactly the problem. And you see, when we talked about, like, why are they focused on this, like, you know, the the one-fifth that is forests or whatever the fraction is, right? Why are forest carbon markets such a large part of the transacted volume? And part of it is because you have forest inventory and analysis data that allows you to trade on a common practice basis. It allows you to reward early adopters for maintaining carbon stocks, just as you reward proactive or new actors for building new carbon stocks. But one of the things that happens when you can reward early adopters for maintaining stocks based on regional practice baselines is that the cash flows move. So not only do I get certainty, but I also don't ask people to pay all of the costs. And when I mean costs, again, risk, new equipment, new practices, learning, and inventory, right? Because I can't do anything for free, and you, Earth Optics, can't do anything for free. So you have to carry all those costs in year one, and then wait 3 years, wait 5 years to grow some uncertain amount of carbon and collect some uncertain amount of money in the future. And I just took students out to a forest that had entered into a forest carbon contract in, I think they entered in 2020, maybe. Their upfront payment, their flush payment on a common practice baseline was $3.4 million on their forest deal. The annual flows was $150,000 because they had built so much carbon, and they were basically saying, we're a working forest and we've been undercutting growth for a long time. We have bills to pay. How about you pay us not to go harvest that growth? And people are willing to pay not to harvest the growth. That really has driven a huge number of carbon credits flowing into forests. You can't do that without trusted regional baselines. And so, again, when we talk about the value that TSIP can add, a big part of what we can add is shifting the whole way that markets can operate. I'm not saying they will operate that way, but we would like to put the data out on the table that allows them to operate in that way if people would like to adopt that style of accounting.
Definitely. Now, Chris, we've got a lot of exciting things to talk about today, so I'm gonna ask that we pivot a little bit just with the remaining time that we have. Now, TSIP has a really exciting grant, and you know, we kind of mentioned grants earlier from the USDA. Could we talk about what that grant entails, what it means for TSIP, and how it's going to push your vision and mission forwards?
Yeah, so we were, so excited. We were awarded a $20 million Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities Award. You know, I think there's a $3.1 billion funding pool that went out. So we're a small portion of this giant enterprise that's happening. You know, Earth Optics is on several of these. It's really, I think, an explosion in the pace of development of both these climate smart commodities, but also the inventory systems that are going to support them, right? Inventory and modeling systems to support it. So we tried to take a pretty comprehensive approach where we said, okay, we see kind of three stories playing out for carbon, right? One is in specialty row crops. And we think about Western specialty row crops where the product that they're producing, the agronomic value of the product is very high, thousands of dollars an acre in produce. And their relative carbon sequestration rate is very low. So they might be growing $20 worth of carbon and having thousands of dollars in net production. The carbon market to really not move the needle for them. But you need the modeling, you need the measurement and the modeling to understand how is it impacting your water. Because if you're operating in the Central Valley of California, you need to understand water. And so we're to kind of get at that kind of market, we partnered with Jackson Family Wines and International Wines for Climate Action to work with a whole lot of vineyards to understand carbon in these really intensively managed, where carbon's at very fine scales and dramatically different between the vine row and the tractor row. And how do we inventory that? How do we understand impact on the commodity? Can we get that kind of inventory there? So we've got a bunch of growers there. Then middle corn, wheat, and soy in the middle U.S., working with Bayer Crop Sciences, 100,000 acres of corn, wheat, and soy, trying to understand, you know, what we see as these big commodity systems. What I'm hearing a lot about is tracking up supply chain. It's not necessarily the individual corn grower that's thinking about a carbon market so much as PepsiCo and others thinking about tracking their supply chain. And is this a Scope 3 claim? Then we've got a bunch of small growers in the East Coast, these sort of like small diversified operations with Glenwood Center for Regional Center for Food and Farming in the Northeast, with adopting agroforestry practices and looking at that with relatively small growers. And then a fantastic partner in Nature for Justice, just was with Chuck, who runs the Farmer Outreach Inclusion Program in North Carolina. That's 100 Black-owned farms, you know, maybe 70 to 100 acres each, diversified. Here, you're kind of in the middle. You're not selling into this commodity market, but you're also not necessarily pulling down enough carbon where it's like a huge part of your bottom line. It may be an additional crop, but it's not going to be a huge part of it. So then are we thinking about resilience and marketing, and how is that playing into, because they're already telling the story of you are locally connected to your food and the producer who makes it and the way that it's grown. And so is climate now a sort of additional part of that story? And so I think those three chunks are really getting in large part where the bulk of this market is going. And so we're trying to think about how do we do inventory in these various spaces. So in each of those cases, we're paying for practice adoption and we're paying for data collection. And we're kind of scaling our system with that approach. And a lot of the funding is also building our back end, all of the sort of web and mobile application development that has to happen to support going from 550 farmers to 500 farmers to 5,000.
Certainly. That's exciting. And congratulations. I mean, that sounds like a really, really neat project. Now, this isn't the first episode that we've talked about climate smart commodities projects. Lars, can you speak to the importance of these projects as they relate to earth optics and carbon and agriculture and kind of your own point of view?
Yeah, I mean, we're really excited about what the USDA has done with this. And obviously, everyone on this call is super, super committed to the value of working land soil as a climate solution. And the markets kind of, you know, the voluntary markets kind of exist a little bit, but we're talking about the like fraction of a percent level globally when it comes to working land. And so I think the USDA has taken an awesome leadership position. And I love the way they're doing it, too, in terms of they're not prescriptively telling everybody, hey, this is the solution to, you know, to producing ingredients that either emit less carbon or actually sequester carbon. They're, you know, basically funding $2.5 billion worth of experiments, you know, public-private partnerships across the U.S. that, you know, now involve, I think, a majority of producers in the U.S. In at least one of these programs, with the goal of, you know, over 5 years, we're having really good visibility into the whole range of solutions that we need in terms of what are the practices that we need to adopt for different cropping systems in different regions and different climates. But what are the markets that need to develop to actually drive new value to producers when they sell not just a commodity ingredient, but now an ingredient that has a pedigree. It's got a climate pedigree, may have a biodiversity pedigree, and other attributes that can be associated with that ingredient. That's kind of the vision. We're big believers and have bought in quite a bit to that. And that's, you know, one of the big reasons why we exist is to help create those data-driven ingredient attributes. And long run, you know, not only improving the climate impact of food production, but helping growers get more revenue per acre than they have in the past. And so I think they got a taste of it with some of these carbon credit programs, but I think that's a drop in the bucket versus what decommoditizing our food production system could bring them. And kind of just to put in perspective, like the analogy that I use is that the box of cornflakes, the corn that goes into it actually costs about the same as the cardboard and the plastic that hold the cornflakes. And so, you know, farmers aren't getting paid a heck of a lot for the actual ingredients. And so if you were just to simply raise the price of a, you know, a carbon neutral cornflake by, you know, even 5%, that would get you something like $200 extra per acre back to the farmer for producing a carbon neutral corn, right? That's real money. You know what I mean? That's a, you know, in many cases, a 20% increase in the revenue that would be all profit. It would probably be a, you know, 200% increase in their profit. So small price changes in the end food product, that if consumers are interested in paying for that small price change to support climate friendly production, it can mean a lot for our rural communities, I think. So that's the long answer version of why we're super excited about these programs and the future that they're helping to bring forth.
Yeah, no, they're terrific programs, and I think the benefits will last for, you know, quite some time. as we're kind of wrapping this episode up, Chris, can you speak to, you know, what are kind of the next steps for TSIP, and you know, how can the growing list of listeners that we have get involved even?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are really focused on the release of the multi-model and thinking about how we can have more growers access that multi-model and the results then flow to markets. And so what we've been doing is we're getting the peer-reviewed part out, get that model released, then start to build the kind of front-end, consumer-facing front-end that allows folks to bring data in. We're building a data uploader so that you can bring in data from any lab, any source, bring that in, have that, then get results out of the multi-model for your individual farm and make comparisons in that smart thermostat, right? And with the idea that that's going to do a couple things. One, it's going to get growers actionable information. Two, it's going to really catalyze these markets because it's going to pull some of those payments up forward and increase confidence, right? And then the other thing that it's going to do is encourage the kind of thing that's just come out with this press release, right? Is this data sharing and data aggregation. And that's another reason why the Soil Inventory Project is science-led, because it allows for-profit entities like Earth Optics, right, to feel confident that when they share data with us, we're going to provide real value back to their customers, and we're going to build up the whole market in a way that is going to really make their businesses more successful. And so I think for anyone who is holding a lot of data, who's out there collecting a lot of data, needs trusted modeling, state of the science modeling, and wants this market to be more successful because of things like access to regional practice baselines, right, that can get you that smart thermostat. We're looking to make more of these data sharing. We want to have a bunch of the data. We're not going to make money with your data. We're a nonprofit organization. We're going to produce value for the whole industry. And so that's what we're looking to do, is to really grow those two sides, to build the value that then allows folks to share and to give you something back for that.
Yeah, I would say that's... Oh, sorry, Gunnar. Sam, that's the part I'm super excited about on behalf of our customers, right? Because we obviously can't share grower data without their permission. And they, to be honest with you, it's valuable. They need something for it. But the results of the multi-model, so what we're trying to create is for all our customers, when we go measure fertility and carbon on their fields, for them to be able to check a box and say, yes, please share my data. I know it's going to be kept private with TSIP. And in exchange for that, they're going to get the results of the multi-model on their field, helping them understand the different choices they're going to be able to make in the future and the likely impact of those. So we're super excited about that as a, you know, kind of a data barter service that farmers are going to have available to them soon.
Yeah, it's all incredibly exciting stuff. Chris and Lars, thank you so much for being on today. I think we covered a lot, and I'm excited to see how this grows. And, you know, for our listeners out there, be on the lookout for the press release that will already be out in the air by the time this episode is released. Chris, is there anything that I missed? Anything else that you'd like to add?
No, thanks. This is an incredibly fun conversation. I really had a great time talking with you all.
Awesome. Yep. Well, thanks again. And for all of our listeners, you can find us, of course, on all of the big platforms out there. Please make sure to leave a like and a review for us. And as always, stay grounded.
Thanks, guys.